Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hey, Diane, what's happening?
I'm not here.
Not officially.
Not officially.
Okay.
So as people are listening, I'm actually in Philadelphia at the Philly Bike Expo. And anybody in the area who wants to stop by and say hi, we're in booth 504. So we obviously pre-recorded this show. At any rate, what's new with you?
Oh, you know, nothing that a good long bike ride wouldn't cure. So
yeah, no kidding.
Which
no
is to
kidding.
Say my life is not bad at all.
Good. Really. I guess if that's all it is just a bike ride will fix it.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Well, it seems that pretty much every second is now occupied by the election. It is just everywhere. It feels like everything else has sort of come to a screeching halt, except there's still riding and racing going on. Can't be all bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been a lot of cyclocross racing going on. That's for sure. As expected, the UCI handed down its decision to strip Lance Armstrong of all 7 TDF jerseys. But less expected, at least on my part, was an open letter written by 3-time Tour de France winner Greg LeMond this week.
The only American to ever win the Tour, by the way.
That's right, and 3 times. on his Facebook page, as well as repeated in an article in USA Today, LeMond almost begs Pat McQuaid to step down from the UCI, as well as own up to his role in the corruption. He actually called him corrupt and said he should, you know, get out of the sport. He also beseeched Paul Kimmage, who, as you know, is embroiled in this UCI defamation suit, which is going to come up in December, I guess, is the trial. He said, what do you care if the UCI takes you to court in Switzerland? He says, I'm an American citizen. If this were up to me, I'd just blow them off and use the money to, quote, lobby for real change, end quote. That's what Greg LeMond said. I thought that was an interesting comment.
You know, if the UCI wasn't corrupt, they were negligent. And if they weren't negligent, they were incompetent, one way or the other. One of those three.
All three, as they say in today's vernacular, fail.
Yeah.
You know, hash mark fail.
I'm hearing some calls for the sport of cycling needs to be clean. We need to have clean cycling.
Taylor Finney had some interesting, I guess he sent out some amazing tweet this week that he was really proud of one of his teammates because he's always raced clean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's that kind of groundswell from the younger crowd that's going to make a difference, I think. And eventually, either McQuaid's going to have to step down because everybody's just going to say, we're not going to listen to you, or another organization will have to come and sort of take over.
Well, you know, who really has some pressure that they can exert on the UCI? Two, actually.
Who?
Well, the International Olympic Committee.
That's true.
Because if they were to say, we're dropping cycling from the Olympics until there's leadership change at the UCI, that would get action.
That's an interesting point, Mr. Priddy.
And the other people who can put pressure on it are the people who buy products from cycling sponsors.
That's true. It's talking with your money.
That's right. Because
that is
if
true.
The sponsors feel the pressure, they will apply pressure in turn, and there will have to be change. But back to this thing, this term clean. I was thinking this week, do you remember back in the 80s when the HIV/AIDS epidemic first happened?
Absolutely.
And the advice was that if you're going to engage in casual sex, you need to use condom, you know, and it was called, what did we call it back then?
Was it clean sex?
No, it was called safe sex.
That's right.
Everybody
safe
was talking
sex.
About
that's
safe
right.
sex. Safe
yeah.
sex.
You're right.
And then a few years passed, and they started not to use the term safe sex. They replaced it with something that was more realistic and more accurate, safer sex. They recognized that while condom use was still appropriate and recommended,
right.
it wasn't a complete panacea. It didn't guarantee you that you weren't going to get HIV.
That's
but
true.
But it dramatically reduced your risk. And I'm going to bring this back around to cycling.
Here it comes. I can see where you're going with it.
Sure. Because cycling, as I've said, will never be clean. I think we need to strive for cycling being cleaner.
Right.
as clean as it can be.
Right.
And that's a realistic goal, and that's a goal that I think people can get behind. Because if you go for clean cycling, what are you always going to be, Diane? Disappointed.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Because it, there's no such thing as the 100%.
That's
right. You know, it's something approachable. There's no such thing as perfection. It's approachable. So I agree. I think that's a very realistic way to look at it.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's see who buys that.
All right.
As they say, run it up the flagpoles. Let's see who salutes it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What do we got going on for tonight?
Well, each of us has our own opinion, obviously, on doping and what it's done to cycling. But another voice, that of Richard Sachs, one of my best buddies, you know, a frame builder, has consistently said, throw the bums out. There's no place for cheaters. He's been very vocal. He has had, I would say, a long history with racing, of course, mostly domestic. I don't know if he ever raced in Europe. But I decided to ask Richard back to the show to hear what he has to say and how he thinks cycling might look in the future. So he's our first guest this evening.
Cool.
And then after our break and some news, we'll talk about a phenomenon that just might be an antidote to training and racing injuries. I think it's a bit over the top for some people, but it seems to be absolutely addictive to many. It's called CrossFit. I first learned about CrossFit from my own kid. My daughter tried it a few sessions a few years ago, and she loved it. It was a little pricey then. Now, I don't know if CrossFit sessions are less pricey now, but one of my friends and yoga students joined a CrossFit box, as they call it, and she loves it. And in fact, I can see what it's kind of done for her. She's just crazy about it, and she's a rower. She's with the Cleveland Rowing organization. So when I was in Vegas at Interbike, my friend from Velo Press, Dave Trendler, asked me if I'd like to review the book Inside the Box by TJ Murphy. And I said yes. TJ's a journalist and endurance athlete. And about the time he was going to give up on running and pretty much everything else athletic due to some very serious nagging injuries, he came across CrossFit and he said he never looked back. It works. TJ will tell us about what CrossFit is, how it works, who can do it, and why so many people have found it to be their new sports addiction in his book, Inside the Box. And then we have some news. So let's snuggle in for a chat with one of my frame building favorites, Richard Sachs. Richie, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Diane.
Yeah.
Good to hear from you again.
It's nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, likewise.
I want to talk to you about your input and your thoughts about the situation with Lance Armstrong, the UCI, all the riders, how you think cycling's going to fare in the long term. Because you have, right from as long as I can remember, been very outspoken about Lance Armstrong and cheating. But do you really believe that Lance is the crux of the problem?
No, he's just the poster boy for it. Well, maybe the crux and the poster boy are the same thing, but you know, he's in the news. His name in the headline is what sells the papers or what gets people to click on websites and read about the stories. You know, whether they're true or not, you know, that's a secondary concern, but as far as, you know, being the crux of it, yeah, he's the crux of it. He not only allegedly used performance-enhancing drugs, but he owned a team that used them. A lot of the people on the team have kind of come forward in the recent few weeks or months. He had a program in effect, according to his former teammates. And, you know, it's one thing when a guy gets caught out, but it's another thing when it's kind of like a, well, like a secret society, and, you know, all the guys in it are finally, like, rolled out onto the carpet for the rest of us to say, we weren't fooled. Thanks for telling us about it, or something like that.
So do you ever remember a time when cycling was clean?
Well, I think for your audience, or maybe even for the two of us in this conversation, you might want to define clean. I'll start by saying if it's not on the ban list, then it's fair game. But for the average American who's been drawn into the sport since the Lance era, you know, I think the mentality is these guys do what they do on food that we all get at the supermarket, you know, Gatorade, bananas, pasta, protein. Well, let's put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised if all of them didn't use performance-enhancing drugs, you know, whether it's for recovery, strength, conditioning, et cetera. But I don't know if all of them used, you know, the drugs that are on the ban list. And then, you know, as far as the ban list goes, you know, that's a revolving door of pharmaceuticals, because some years, you know, you could get caught, you know, testing positive for something that's only going to be on the ban list starting the following season. You know, Pedro Delgado in the late 80s is a good example of that. He was winning the Tour, and he got, you know, busted for probenecid, which I probably am not, you know, pronouncing correctly, but that's a masking agent. But when they realized that it wasn't on the list, it was like, fine. So I think your audience and, you know, the mainstream needs to decide for themselves what the word clean means.
Well, and that's interesting, because Greg and I had a conversation about that earlier this evening, about it could be cleaner rather than clean. So you're right. You know, you're never going to maybe perhaps have 100% clean. And this week, Taylor Finney also came out with a tweet that says, my guy Cummings, you know, won the race pure, no caffeine. You know, I mean, they're looking at no painkillers, you know, Tylenol, aspirin. And I'm thinking, well, even though those aren't banned substances, are we going, you know, sort of to the other end of the leash? Is the pendulum swinging way in the opposite direction for these young riders?
Well, I heard about that. You know, I don't really pay any attention to stuff like that. You know, that's probably a reaction to the situation that's going on in the last few weeks or months. But, you know, for the record, or at least for the conversation, I don't have any problem with any of these guys taking anything. There are so few of them in the world making a living at what they do that it's almost laughable that anybody would care. What, there's like 300 of them in the world, 400 of them in the world at the most. And we want to be entertained, and we won't be entertained unless these guys do things that we can't do on the weekend. So to that end, I think the sport's always been, quote-unquote, dirty. I think the sport has always had riders who have done as much as they can, or as, you know, as whatever they had to beat the other riders that they were racing against. And I accept that. I've never felt differently. Going back to like the 70s when I first was exposed to it, it's just that, as far as I'm concerned, the hypocrisy is when somebody, and this goes back to your original word, at the crux of this, like Lance, has the opportunity to say, well, come on. We're asking everybody to come clean because we're investigating a scandal here. It's not just, you know, a positive test. We're investigating a scandal. And the guy continually lies about it. I have a problem with the lying. I don't have a problem with the cheating, because unless you actually get caught, you know, you can't say the guy cheated. But when everything in the public domain is so pointed to, you know, what we have now, you know, I don't like the guy looking in the camera and saying, I'm on my bike 7 hours a day, or are you calling me a doper or a liar, or any of those really awesome sound bites that the guy has had in the last 10 years. It's just insulting to me and to the audience. So that's where I come into this.
I have a question about the responsibility and where it might lie in terms of needing to be faster and stronger and ride longer and harder. Do you think team owners themselves have a responsibility and knew what was going on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Everybody's involved. And, of course, you know, I can see, like, the lawyers parked outside of my house after a comment like that. But the thing is, the sport's always been dirty, meaning, like I said earlier, that doesn't mean they've taken, you know, banned substances. I just think they try to get away with as much as they can, much like in other sports. But, you know, let's just stay with cycling. I think the distances that they have to ride, the season's duration, the amount of starts that, you know, the riders have to do, the things that the owners want in return for their investment, I think the stakes are pretty high. So I think everybody knows what's going on. It's just that the owners don't want to acknowledge that, you know, they have people on staff that do this. They just hope that they can get away with it. That's a blanket statement I'll make. And I can't imagine anybody comes into the sport of cycling in the late 20th century or in the early 21st century and doesn't know its history. I think what they want is to have the rolling billboards that these guys really are, so that their products can be branded all over the papers on the, you know, the TV coverage, you know, for 10 months, 9 months of a year, and, you know, get their name noticed by, you know, the people that buy their mattresses, or the people that buy their, you know, courier services, or the people that buy their pharmaceuticals. I mean, at the end of the day, or certainly at the beginning of the day, cycling is as much about advertising as it is about athletics. I mean, we'd have no sport if there were no, like, names on the jerseys.
Well, that's a really interesting point, which took me right to the next question, and that is, don't you think it's truly hypocritical that sponsors turn around and then kind of smack their riders by dropping them when they knew what was going on in the first place?
I got to tell you, Diane, you know, there's this line from The Godfather where Michael Corleone says to Senator Geary something or other, and then it ends with, you know, we're all part of the same hypocrisy, or we're both part of the same hypocrisy.
Right.
All of us, you, me, any fan, any writer, anybody that advertises in a magazine that covers the sport, certainly anybody that drives the team car, all the helpers and the owners and the broadcasters, Phil and Paul, et cetera, all of us know what's going on. Now, I'm sure that there's a small percentage of people that came into the sport because of Lance and the cancer thing that thought, well, this is a great Cinderella story. I am now hooked on cycling, and I'm following the sport because of this man. And I feel bad for those people. You know, I feel good that some people's hopes were elevated because of the story that, you know, we all in the sport and hopefully in the trade knew was smoke and mirrors. But now that this guy's, you know, house of cards has, you know, been blown away, you know, these people that were new to the sport that thought this was real, that they thought this guy did it on training 7 hours a day and, you know, ambition and motivation and training and coaching. I mean, these people, I have no idea. These people have turned into turncoats, too. And I think all of us share the responsibility because we watch a sport, we buy the products, we talk about it, and nobody does anything or says boo as a result. You know, this thing is not the first time we've had a drug story in the sport. I don't remember the sport as not having a drug story, period. But because of being in the States and this being an American-centric story, you know, it's much more focused on it now than the Festina affair or the G-Wiz. Was it G-Wiz? I forget, with Evgeny Berzin and all those people in the early 90s or whenever it was.
Yeah, I think that's
I mean, there's always a story. I mean, none of this surprises anybody who's been in the sport for any kind of time.
That's true. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Richard Sachs, who, as always, is extremely eloquent about this and has such an interesting and spot-on perspective, I think. How do you think cycling might have looked if there had been no doping?
You mean pro racing?
Pro racing. Oh, yeah, no. I mean, I guess we're just talking about the Peloton here, you know, these teams, and it's the, you know, it's the Formula One part of our business.
You know, you've heard me say this many times before, so I'll say it again for your audience. We're the sport. These idiots are just the floor show.
That's true. You do say that. I always forget that.
They're the entertainment. You know, when they get knocked over, there's more entertainment in the wings ready to entertain us. We turn on the television because we're conditioned to it, and we follow the Velo News on the cyclingnews.com because we're racing cyclists, or we're cyclists who have followed the sport for a number of years. And, you know, my perspective is their entertainment. You know, sure, they're doing something athletic, but they're there to entertain me. For the sponsors, they're there to sell whatever name or brand is on their back, period. So it's almost as though the race results themselves are secondary or tertiary or not even important. But as long as these guys get photographed, then, you know, the brands get free advertising on the front page of the sports section. They get 7 hours of exposure on the television when there's a feed, etc. If they didn't take anything, I guess the Tour de France would end in September because it would probably take that long if using cream of wheat and bananas and Gatorade
right.
to recover and, you know, start again the next morning. You know, I make light of it, but the truth is, you know, it'll never be clean. There's way too much, you know, you didn't ask the question. I'm just going to tell you this right now because I've said it a lot lately. I think the tour or the grand tours, you know, for your audience that doesn't follow the sport, you know, there's three or so grand tours. The Tour de France is the most notorious one. I think that business model has long since, you know, passed its sell-by date. You know, the tours, especially the Tour de France, was conceived to sell newspapers back in the early 1900s or the late 1800s. I don't know because I don't.
It was a long time ago.
That's before my time. But, you know, I can understand in those eras that they wanted to find ways to, you know, create or, you know, exploit a brand, which was, you know, the newspaper that, you know, sponsored the event. But it's turned into a freaking three-ring circus. There's a certain breed of cat that doesn't even know that bike racing occurs from February to October. They think that bike racing and the Tour de France are one and the same.
Right.
But a true connoisseur or a true cycling buff or a racing buff, you know, thinks as much or more than of the classics and the, you know, the worlds and the other disciplines as the average Joe armchair, you know, with his remote control, probably thinks of the tour. You know, that the rest of us follow the sport, such as it is, and some people who are latecomers follow the tour. And when the tour's over, they wouldn't even know that these guys are still racing two days later or 2 weeks later. I think, you know, I'm probably in the small minority, but I think the tour has to go. I think, and it's not going to go because nobody's going to, like, care what I think, but, you know, it's just not relevant, you know?
What else might take its place? How important is it to cycling? How is this racing important to cycling? What else might take its place to keep it as exciting and interesting?
You know, it's hard to answer your question because, first of all, you know, I think the first thing that should happen is all the users and the positive tests and everybody who, you know, said that they once were part of it should be shown the door and thrown out of cycling, period. No six-month suspension, no second chances, just get them out. You know, everybody that's been testifying lately, and today it was Bobby Julich, everybody says, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it, I was sucked into it. Great. See ya. I mean, on one hand, we need to do that. We need to clean all of these guys out of the sport and then see what's left. If anybody's still left, you know, they should agree, you know, to say that they don't have a story. And if they get caught, you know, with a backdated story, they get thrown out too. But personally, if there was no bike racing on television, I'd be out riding my bike, or I'd be in the shop, or, you know, walking across the field with Deb and Buddy or whatever. That's what people should do. These guys, there's a whole world of things to do besides watch these idiots, you know, try to go up a mountain. You know, they have like eight guys leading a leader to the base of the mountain, which is like 99% of the race, and then the leader gets launched, and he goes up the top, and he's called the winner. You know, I don't get that. I never got that. You know, I've been watching these races for four decades, and this stuff is just, I watch it because it's there, and if it ended tomorrow, I wouldn't miss it at all. I don't think cycling needs pro racing as much as other people might think it does, but you're talking to me, so that's kind of where I stand on it.
Well, and I appreciate that. I appreciate it a lot, and I wanted your opinion. And
yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. We're beginning to run out of time for this time, and you know I'm going to invite you back again because I love having you on the show. But Greg, I think, has a question. Greg.
What I want to know is how you reconcile or bring together the two viewpoints that you sort of expressed at the beginning and the end of this conversation. First, you said you didn't have a problem with cheating, and then just recently you said anybody who's cheated should be thrown out. So bring those two together for me because I'm confused.
Well, no problem. You see, in my opinion, or according to my opinion, cycling was much better before it got quote-unquote Americanized, before the Lance thing, before Postal showed up, before Weisel and all the Americans with their corporate jets and their, you know, boardroom tactics went to Europe and tried to appropriate the sport as its own. I think the sport is an old man sport. I think it's a pre-war sport. It's a pre-television sport. It's not unlike boxing. It's a little bit like, you know, Rollerball, the movie or the book. To a certain extent, it's unbelievable, like, you know, wrestling is. And, you know, when I was a kid, I got into it. But it never occurred to me that what they were doing was real. It never bothered me. So when people talk about Omerta or the way things used to be, I accept that the entertainment I get in return for watching or, you know, everything else, if there's something wrong with it and they're cheating, I don't care. But if you get caught, you just take your time out, you shut up, and then you come back. That's the way it always was. Sport kind of runs itself. Ever since the sport got Americanized, ever since it became like a big business here in the States with Lance and the tour and the broadcast and all the people that follow it, I kind of feel like, okay, it's the same, but if you go up to the microphone and say, I don't cheat, I pass 500 tests, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, hey, I don't care what you do, but don't go afterwards and say your successes were done without the cheating or without the, you know, the PEDs, because it's insulting. So, you know, on one hand, I don't want to know because I already do know. It's not possible to do this stuff clean because it would take forever to finish most of the races. Does that help you?
So it's basically the institutional blind eye that keeps getting turned to all of this.
Yeah.
In favor of, you know, trying to promote a sport that is allegedly clean, but everybody knows it's not.
It'll never be clean. It never was clean. What we have now is just what we have now. It'll go away, and we'll have another episode in a year, in a few years, and we'll look back at this as like our generation's Festina affair.
Interesting.
But I accept it, and I just, you know, I'll keep watching it as long as it's there, mainly because, you know, it's kind of fun, and I also feel that the entertainment value that I get from pro cycling comes as much from the backstory and these issues making the news and, you know, the personalities getting rolled out into the carpet and we find out what these people are really made of. I find that as entertaining or more entertaining than the sport itself. And to me, it's like one big stew and inseparable.
Well, Richard, either you and I are two of the smartest guys on the planet because we both have kind of the same viewpoint on this, or we're two complete nutballs. One of the two.
Wait a minute. Do they have to be mutually exclusive? All right, Richard. Well, it's, as always, wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for...
Well, thanks for calling, and you guys have a nice afternoon. Okay?
All right. Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Okay.
Richard Sachs joined us from...
The East Coast. He's in New England somewhere.
He's up in New England
somewhere.
Yeah,
I can never remember where he lives.
One of them states up there.
One of them their states.
There's a famous quote by a British gentleman. I couldn't find the exact attribution.
Yeah.
It says, if you believe those boys ride up mountains on salads and fizzy water, you're quite mistaken.
Yes.
I think that kind of summarized what Richard was saying.
That pretty much says it all. You got it.
All right.
Okay.
Well, always great to talk to Richard Sachs.
It was. And boy, he has such interesting insight.
And a great way of presenting them, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to present you with a little break here.
Okay.
And then we come back and do some news, and we talk about CrossFit.
We will.
Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland. 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Who was your hero when you were a kid?
Neil Armstrong or Louis Armstrong?
Roberto Clemente or Walter Cronkite? Rosa Parks or Sally Ride?
You're the right age to do something you can be remembered for.
Register to become an organ and tissue donor.
Even if you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, or beyond, any age is the right age to donate the gift of life.
Learn how at organdonor.gov or call 1-866-99-DONATE. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Sitting across from me right here is Diane Lees.
And sitting across from me, working the board, is Greg Priddy.
And although, actually, I lied, Diane is in Philadelphia right at this very moment. But virtually, she and I are here.
That's true.
And we're ready to dive into some news on the Outspoken Cyclist this week.
And what's interesting is a lot of the news emanates from Ohio, and it's coincidental because I didn't really look for it. It just all came up. A Kent, Ohio man was pulled over last week after a witness called Bath Township Police to report erratic driving, according to a Bath Township Police report. Police spotted Stephen Meyer, 35, weaving between Interstate 77 highway lanes and pulled him over on the afternoon of October 19th, according to the report. He was asked to perform sobriety test, which he failed. He blew a 0.099 in a blood alcohol breath test. During the stop, officers searched Meyer's car and found 4 pounds of marijuana and $1,764 in cash. Bath Township Police charged Meyer with driving under the influence, blah, 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 blah. Meyer is the co-owner of Kent Cycle, a new cycling shop in Kent that will be moving into the Akron Corner redevelopment area. I'm like, what the heck's up with that?
Is he a mountain biker?
I have no idea. I don't know. I've never. Huh? In fact, I don't know of the shop. I looked it up online, and it only has a main page so far. So it evidently, I don't know if it's open or not. We all know about Press Camp and Dealer Camp next year. And I think this is such a good idea. I think Interbike really needs to sit back and take a look. Dealer Camp is announcing that on the final day of Ride and Decide Dealer Camp for 2013 in Deer Valley, that there will be a consumer day. So it'll be staged Thursday and Friday, the 25th and 26th of July, with Saturday, the 27th, being a public day at the Deer Valley Resort above Park City. And I'll tell you what, if you live in the Utah area, Salt Lake or Park City or anywhere around there, and want to have a really good time, you're going to be invited as a consumer to go ride bikes up and down Mid-Mountain and do all kinds of cool stuff. And I think it's a great idea. So you and I both have sort of chip-in kind of things. I would like to remind people that if you are so inclined, the chip-in fund for Paul Kimmage is still accepting donations. As of this week, it was up to $80,000. Nobody knows how much it's going to cost him to defend himself. His trial is coming up on December 12th. The UCI did not drop its defamation case, although it was asked to, against Paul. You can always go to cyclismus.com and read about it. And I know we've been waiting for this to come up with the gentleman who drowned in the triathlon this summer. So you have that information.
Right. So the triathlon community here in Northeast Ohio lost one of their members this summer at the Greater Cleveland Triathlon at Menor Headlands. Stan Bugarsik is the gentleman's name. And after some time for his death to settle and his family to kind of get the affairs in order, the triathlon community has organized an online raffle. You can go to imathlete.com. And search for his name, although it may not come up. So we'll post a link on the Facebook and Outspoken Cyclist and WJCU.org and all of that. But basically, it runs through December 8th, and you can buy a raffle ticket, and there's some really nice prizes like a Nike Olympic team jacket, some gift certificates. If you are a triathlete, there are some Rev3 full and half distance applications for next year. So some nice triathlete oriented prizes for the raffle. And once again, that is imathlete.com. Fundraising raffle going on through December 8th for Stan Bugarsik.
And we've sort of been waiting for that. We knew there was going to be a fundraiser for his family. And I'm sure they are still just, you know, walking around in zombie land. And if this helps, you know, I think it's awesome thing.
Yeah, a little cash in the pocket definitely takes some of the stress off, at least.
He was a young guy.
Yeah,
who knows what he had in insurance.
I think,
and,
yeah.
You know, he's got, what, 2 young kids? So I'm not sure why Ohio is playing a big role. Maybe it's because we're the big swing state. But this is from the Columbus Dispatch. It's my last item today. And this is a victory for cyclists. Unfortunately, the cyclist who got the victory can only enjoy it in a whole different way in his life. It was written by Lucas Sullivan, posted on October 23rd. Potholes cost Columbus, Ohio $1.25 million. The bicyclist was left a quadriplegic after bypassing a hazard. Columbus City Council agreed to pay $1.25 million to settle a lawsuit that said large potholes on a city street contributed to a crash that left a bicyclist paralyzed, a decision that puts cities across the state on notice that they can be held liable for streets in disrepair. W. Justin Crabtree will be awarded the settlement. He sued the city, saying the potholes on Williams Road on the city's south side were a factor in his bicycle crash with a car in January 2006. So we're talking almost 7 years ago.
Wow.
Crabtree and his friend Terry Blake were riding bikes when Andre Cook tried to pass them in his car, according to court documents. Cook passed Blake but struck Crabtree, who was left a quadriplegic. A witness said Crabtree had to ride toward the center of the road right before the crash because of potholes in his path. Crabtree and his attorney, John M. Alton, took the city to court, saying it was negligent, but they lost the common pleas decision. They appealed to the 10th District Court of Appeals, which reconsidered the city's argument that it couldn't be held liable for nuisances such as potholes or malfunctioning traffic lights. The appeals court ruled last November that the city might be liable for, quote, any negligent failure to keep public roads in repair, end quote, and remanded the case back to court. A mediator suggested the settlement, which was reached within the past month. This is a significant settlement, said Jeff Cox, chief counsel for city attorney Richard C. Pfeiffer, Jr. It is recommended that we reach the settlement because of the significant injuries sustained by Mr. Crabtree. Crabtree and his attorney could not be reached for comment. But even though $1.25 million sounds like a big number, for somebody who's a quadriplegic, who knows what kind of care he's going to need for the rest of his life. So I'm glad to see that that the court was smart enough, first of all, to kick it back and then to send it to mediation, mm-hmm. and then it got settled. So good for them.
The very best cycling infrastructure is a well-maintained road.
Yes, no kidding.
If you can hold that line, well, because you're not dodging potholes and other obstacles, you are much safer with the cars.
Wasn't somebody on one of the Columbus trails killed and a good cyclist from hitting one of those center posts this year?
Yeah.
Remember
that? I don't think that was in Columbus. But
oh,
it was
Mansfield area, maybe. Yeah. So that's all the news for this week.
No, I have two items.
Okay. I lied. That is not all the news for this week.
Well,
Go for it.
Just one item.
Okay.
So Gucci, the Italian style titan, has partnered with bicycle maker Bianchi, and they have produced a $14,000 urban and off-road bike. It's 11 speeds, made of carbon fiber, of course, designed by Frida Giannini, Gucci's creative director. And among the non-traditional features of this bike is a frame decorated with the label's trademark stripes and the Gucci logo stitched into the bike's custom leather seat. If you're going to fork over $14,000 for a bicycle, you may as well pop for the matching $890 helmet and the $105 water bottle.
Give me a break. You know, for $14,000, you can have two of the finest custom-made bikes on the planet.
But do they have Gucci labels on them?
Do we want Gucci labels on them? Anyway, I'm not a Gucci label person.
Here's something interesting in this article, which actually
is
from thedaily.com, by the way.
Okay.
And a fellow DJ here at the station at WJCU, Fred Dolan, sent this to me. The bicycle doesn't offer suspension. It doesn't offer fenders. And quoted in the write-up on thedaily.com is our friend Jim Papadopoulos.
Really?
Yeah, from Northwestern University.
Yes, I remember our little interview with him.
Yeah. It's four times the price of Bianchi's next most costly off-roading bike. And Gucci says Bianchi chose not to use a suspension fork to save on weight and that a fender is unnecessary for an urban bike.
Oh, yes. And they are so well informed, by the way. So, you know, with
because if you're going to ride a Gucci bike, are you going to ride it in the rain?
Yeah, right.
Of course not.
Well, and Gucci, you know, it's less is more. Always. You know, understated.
Right.
You know, and by the way, of course it's in black. You can wear pearls.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we should move on.
Anyway, that's the news.
All right. Well, it's time to talk about something really gritty as opposed to Gucci, and that is CrossFit. T.J. Murphy is the author of a new book, Inside the Box, by our friends at Velo Press, How CrossFit Shredded the Rules, Stripped Down the Gym, and Rebuilt My Body. Let's welcome T.J. Murphy to the Outspoken Cyclist. T.J., thanks for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you so much, Diane. I'm glad to be here.
Well, and I'm excited to learn more about CrossFit, although I learned a lot from your book, Inside the Box. I want to start with your running background and why you turned to CrossFit and how you found CrossFit. I know you're a journalist and a triathlete, but fill us in on your background and endurance sport in general.
Sure. Well, I became a runner in 1989 when I got the marathon bug and did my first marathon called the Big Sur Marathon. And this was before I became a journalist. I'd actually studied theater and playwriting in college, and the whole world of marathon running and then triathlon was so addictive for me because I really liked the fact that it was this sort of individual challenge where you got out of it precisely what you put in. So if you did the training, you were rewarded with these accomplishments that, like finishing a marathon or finishing an Ironman, that before I'd started, I remember I couldn't even really imagine doing. So it was very rewarding in that respect. The thing about it is, like a lot of runners, and research sort of indicates that 70% of American runners deal with at least one injury per year. Long-distance running has quite a record in terms of breaking you down physically, and the older I've become, the more I've dealt with chronic injuries. So the last 10 years, quite frankly, I did less running and more just trying to get past injuries so I could run. And at the point where I became aware of CrossFit, I had so many injuries going on. I had my back was going out. I had Achilles tendonitis problems, piriformis sciatica. I remember as I was in my chair at the office at the time, I was editorial director of Triathlete Magazine and Inside Triathlon Magazine, and I could barely walk around the office without a limp. I had a really bad limp, as a matter of fact. And the more I was researching CrossFit for a story for Triathlete Magazine, and I was just hearing these stories from other triathletes and runners about how CrossFit was saving them from injury, making them stronger than ever, and I realized I had no excuses but to try it myself to see if what they were saying really worked.
So let's define CrossFit, and then we'll come back to how you got into it, because other things were going on in your life too. I mean, your story was really compelling. Reading it, you know, it's like your whole world was kind of falling apart.
Yes. So it was all happening at the same time.
And it's interesting that I have talked to other people on the show who have pretty much said the same thing, that when they got to that certain point, you know, I'm in the middle of a divorce and I lost my job. And all of a sudden, something like this happened. So tell us what CrossFit is, first of all, so that we can get past that part.
The technical definition is functional movement performed at high intensity. And that clinical definition doesn't do much. I would say what CrossFit is, it's kind of the reverse of what you see at a typical gym, as opposed to exercises on machines that isolate muscles that are done, slowly, without much sort of aerobic stimulation. CrossFit is these combinations of functional movements like burpees, push-ups, running, rowing, pull-ups, weightlifting, powerlifting, and constantly varying combinations. Every day you go into a CrossFit class, it's a whole different thing that you never really adapt to. So you're getting this tremendous training stimulus. It's always in a group environment, and it's with coaches that are really picky about movement. So it's classic exercises, like from things like the squat, the push-up, running, pull-ups, but put together in combinations that are extremely taxing, very demanding, and in almost every case, talk across people who got into CrossFit who've been doing it for a few months, the results are just staggering. So that's CrossFit, if that helps you.
You just said the results are almost staggering. Tell me what some of the results of CrossFit could be.
Sure. Well, it's going to vary from person to person,
sure,
depending on how they're coming into it and their background. But, for example, in the book, one of the folks I mentioned, Irene Mahia, who started when she was 415 pounds, was morbidly obese, and her thing was weight loss. And, you know, she's down well below 300 pounds now and is fit as an athlete, very strong and mobile and can run and do all these things. In my case, my body fat through that very stressful period of time in my life had gone way up. I think I measured it 25 or 26% body fat. And for I used to be this 238 marathon guy, and it was just I was depressing to be following that direction. My results were rapid body fat loss, an increase in muscle mass, increases in flexibility, mobility. And as a runner for 20 years, if you'd asked me to jump onto a box, a 12-inch box or anything like that, I would have looked at it like it was a building. Runners typically don't have much of a vertical jump. But after not that long in CrossFit, I was able to jump in a 24-inch box and even a 30-inch box. And I'm 49 years old, and I don't think I could have done that except back in my high school years. So all these athletic capacities are unleashed, and I have to say, having been an athlete for a long time, I was pretty startled by how fast those results came.
As I was going through it, I was looking at the equipment, and I know that this is, it's sort of like a stripped down gym. Explain what the word, you know, it's inside the box, and explain right. What the box is.
Yeah, CrossFit gyms are called boxes because most often they are located in warehouse type spaces, just a raw chunk of space where, you know, a typical gym can be overloaded with machines, everything from leg presses to push up to press machines and such. A box is really quite honestly that. It's this raw chunk of space. On the side there might be some pull-up bars, and it is very basic equipment. It's it's very old school in that respect. You're talking about barbells, medicine balls, kettlebells, jump ropes. And that's a rowing machine is about as high-tech as they seem to get.
Well, I noticed, you know, when I was reading it, the book, I'm thinking, wow, this sounds like my high school was. You know, you had some, because rings were also mentioned. I'm thinking rings, ropes, mats. You know, I don't remember doing weights in high school, but it's simple stuff. And so you do, of course, and the book says you really should be dealing with a coach, though. You shouldn't be trying to do this stuff on your own.
Sure. And to that point, Greg Glassman is the founder of CrossFit. He created it in a little gym that he put together in Santa Cruz around 2000. And he had long been making the case that a set of these gymnastics rings, you know, two wooden rings with some canvas straps, were a far more valuable and vital training tool if used properly to get a training effect than, say, a $15,000 traps training machine that you might find at a big gym. But the key is, just like you mentioned, there's all this talk about how you can get hurt in CrossFit, and that is the case if you don't have good coaching. You really do need good coaching, and I needed it. I tried doing it on my own at first. I followed the website, and I was doing these things like deadlifts and clean and jerks at a gym, and I didn't realize how poorly I was doing those movements until I joined a gym, which is where I sort of pick up the narrative in the book, and coaches were teaching me, and that's what they do. They every day they're watching very carefully, because technique is the way to get the value from the exercises and also to do them safely. So that's a real crucial component of this whole CrossFit thing.
Let me take a moment and remind our listeners we're speaking with TJ Murphy. He's the author of Inside the Box, How CrossFit Shredded the Rules, Stripped Down the Gym, and Rebuilt My Body. I want to talk a little bit about nutrition, because before you started CrossFit, you thought being a vegan was a good idea.
Yeah, I was actually sort of, I was going through that time with my life sort of falling to pieces a bit with the divorce and all that, and I gained all this weight, and Scott Jurek is a famous ultra runner who was a key character in the best-selling book Born to Run, and he was a vegan, and I thought, well, you know, that seems like a pretty precise way to clean up my diet and maybe get some weight loss that way. Which was the case. I did actually lose weight being a vegan, and it was tricky. But one of the things that also happened, in my case, I wasn't doing it well enough or something, but I was eating such a high level of carbohydrates that a blood test revealed that I was actually becoming pre-diabetic.
Oh, nice.
Right. So there's a photograph of me in my vegan days, and I look at it now, and I'm like, and I really looked unhealthy. So I'm not by any means saying that being a vegan is wrong. I just, whatever I was doing, I was not doing it right. And nutrition is sort of the foundational component of a CrossFit program. You join a gym, and that's going to be one of the first things that coaches talk to you about. And protein is a nutrient that they talk in depth about. And By balancing my macronutrient sort of ratios, a balance of protein, fats, and carbohydrate, I continued to lose weight, put on muscle mass, get stronger, get fitter, but I also was healthier and sleeping better. So that was kind of, in a nutshell, the path that happened for me.
When you go to one of the CrossFit boxes and the coaches there, they do work with you to do the nutrition?
Yeah, well, one of the, you know, CrossFit, they're not creating new exercises. There's no sort of new technology like you sort of referenced, Diane. It's some old school stuff, but with the innovation, it really is this competitive group dynamic. They create a small community. These gyms typically have 100 people or less in them, as opposed to thousands that a big gym might have.
Sure.
And then they'll have, like for example, CrossFit Elysium, which is the gym that I'm at in the course of the book, had a nutrition challenge. So they set up a thing with a point system, and I guess Weight Watchers does something like this, but you're actually these people you become friends with, that you see every day, that you train with every day. You join in, and they start off with a lecture on proper nutrition, and then you go through, we went through a six-week sort of program. There was actually kind of a competition, like whoever sort of accumulated the most points got a little prize. But in the course of that, you not only learn about some of the ideas of nutrition, but you're pushed and motivated to put them into practice, and there's accountability to yourself, your coach, and your gym mates. And so, in other words, it's some of the stuff is classic stuff, but it's just made more effective. And the workouts, by the way, are far more vital because of this group competitive dynamic.
Well, and there are competitions, which are really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you relate your first one trying to do these competitions. The time limit was 10 minutes. And I'm like, how's he going to do all those reps in 10 minutes? You know? And you said the same thing, actually. How am I going to do that?
Yeah. I like to make a point that I was extremely skeptical of this CrossFit thing when I was first looking at it and first reporting on it for Triathlete Magazine. And I'm very much a classical distance runner, and it just looked like a kind of a, well, what's this crazy fitness fad? But the more I dug into it, the more I talked to people, I realized there was actually a lot of structure being put in place, and the results, I just couldn't argue with what I was hearing. So it was all anecdotal, but it was so much of it, I had to try it. And then that was one of the key points I try to make in the book. A lot of people judge CrossFit, or they might judge triathlon or cycling from a distance, but that's one thing. I've actually become a person that now, rather than just read what the research is saying, I want to. If I see something that's good and I hear good things about it, I'll make a decision based on my own sort of self-test, and that's kind of what I did in the book. I actually said, "All right, I hear all these things are telling me about how the training works," and I would put myself. I would just like record my results and set these goals the way they said, and with all the skepticism, I would go, okay, we'll see if it works or not. And in my case, the things I was doing as a 48-year-old athlete, I never would have imagined. If you told me when I was 45 that I would be doing that stuff that I was able to accomplish within the reporting period for the book, I would have just not believed you at all. I would have thought you're crazy. And yet, I outperformed what I even imagined I was capable of doing. So it was a surprise.
The book is really interesting, and it's well written. I like it. It's well laid out, and you give
thank you
a lot of interesting anecdotal stuff. Plus, it does show you how to do a lot of these things, including handstands and headstands, which is something that I don't any longer teach in yoga, but I used to. So I have one last question, and how this wraps back into our main sports, which are cycling and triathlon. Do you think CrossFit is complementary to other sports?
Well, here's the deal about CrossFit. It really is, and it basically, if you go through the literature, it's a general program. However, the philosophy is such that whatever sport you might choose, be it fencing or be it triathlon or cycling, if you don't have a broad athletic foundation, the CrossFit thinking goes, you're not going to reach your potential in your chosen specific sport. And that's kind of what I definitely saw at work with talking with various experts, especially a physical therapist named Kelly Starrett, who is a CrossFit gym owner, and he's kind of the guru of movement and mobility. For example, in triathlon, if you don't have a strong core, if you don't have a good infrastructure where you're really using the muscles, the hamstrings, the glutes, the core body to support your spine, then there's really no way you can sustain the best speed you possibly could in, for example, a 112-mile bike ride. You're
right.
just not going to be able to hold that position. So there's a thing about developing, and that's what I went in doing, was redeveloping my sort of foundation as an athlete with the idea of taking it and becoming a better runner ultimately.
I get it. And so you, how often do you do CrossFit? I mean, it's not a daily, or is it daily?
Well, the typical program is 3 days on, okay. 1 day off. It varies. A lot of people do it differently. Beginners are going to do it less because there is an adaptation period. And then there is a sort of variation of CrossFit called CrossFit Endurance, which is designed specifically for runners and triathletes and cyclists, that combines a kind of a low-mileage, high-intensity running or triathlon or cycling program with four CrossFit classes per week. And so, and that's one of the things in talking to triathletes and runners in cities across the country that are using these programs, that was kind of the thing that really began to perk my interest, because they were telling me they were not only becoming defeating injury better, but they were actually achieving personal record performances. So that's when I had to like screw myself up and give it a try.
The book is Inside the Box, How CrossFit Shredded the Rules, Stripped Down the Gym, and Rebuilt My Body by TJ Murphy. TJ, thank you so much for spending time talking with us.
Well, thanks so much, Dan. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much. Have a good night.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
TJ Murphy joined us from the Bay Area of Northern California.
Want to try some CrossFit?
Boy, the results sound enticing. I think the process
is grueling.
Yes.
There's
some pain involved there, I think.
A brand new CrossFit studio just opened up in Mayfield Heights, I think.
Really?
Well, and the one that Kate, my friend, goes to is in, I want to say, downtown.
I always say that I only have time enough to be mediocre at one sport. I don't have time to be mediocre at two or three or four.
That's very interesting, Greg.
Hey, what
okay,
can you say?
I needed a good laugh. That's a good one.
All right. Well, you'll be back here in person next week.
Yes, I will.
With Tales from the Philly Bike Show.
Tales from Philadelphia, my birthplace.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Okay.
All right.
Well, join us in another week for another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. And until then, ride safely.
And bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.